A university is dedicated to the nobility of each individual person through whom the wonders of this vast universe are groped for, enjoyed, and enriched. Talent, skill, intellectual curiosity are not enough. Our studying and teaching, our discussing and criticizing, our observing and reporting, our living together must be oriented toward increasing the nobility of each of us. When these activities and this orientation are marvelously mixed in the personality of an individual, we realize that in that single life resides the meaning of the university. It is therefore fitting that the University of Alaska recognizes in the life of Ivor Scarland, its late alumnus and professor, those qualities, those very human qualities, that help define this institution. Because we believe that through the review of some of the aspects of his life, we can gain some perspective on those qualities that make men noble, we come together for a few minutes of recall, of memory, of Ivor Scarland, professional anthropologist, teacher, and friend.
Give a rough paraphrased quotation from Shakespeare, a man in his time plays many parts. As an individual, Dr. Scarland, I'm certain, had more facets than even Shakespeare might have imagined. But I shall consider only Dr. Scarland, the professional anthropologist, and his contribution to the state, to the nation, and to the world. An anthropologist, by dictionary definition, deals with the scientific study of man from prehistory to the present. And especially in the study of living man, one must, through his interpersonal relationships, develop a climate, a rapport from which he can draw information. Stated more negatively, without these characteristics, information is not forthcoming. Ivor was without peer when it came to his personal dealings with others. His complete absence of pomposity, his wit, and his ability to listen and learn added not only to his eminence as a scientist, but to his stature as an individual. One need only travel throughout the state of Alaska, regardless of how small the community, to find that Dr. Scarland had friends. Immediately upon identification as a staff member, one was asked upon his return to pass regards along to Ivor. While it's common to obtain prestige by being identified with an institution of higher learning, when this institution has prestige, the University of Alaska gained prestige by being identified with Ivor Scarland. And of course, his close identification with the university, even to some, he was the University of Alaska, was of long standing. Professional contributions take many different forms, and it's virtually impossible to attempt to determine where Dr. Scarland's greatest contribution might have lain. But risky as this type of evaluation is, I would suggest that first and foremost, Dr. Scarland was a teacher. And if my judgment is in error, at least I should beg for some mercy in that my own personal bias is showing. I feel no greater tribute can be paid to man than to say of him, he was a great teacher. To begin with, I received no quarrel in making the statement to members of the faculty when I stated that Dr. Scarland taught more students during his tenure at the University of Alaska than any other staff member, past or present, He enjoyed teaching the introductory courses as much as the advanced offerings. And it was a standing rule that any time Dr. Scarland would be available or willing to teach workshops or short courses in any community in the state, he was received with enthusiasm. The course in Alaskan Natives, which by common knowledge and consent should have been renamed in the catalog Ivor Scarland 342 rather than Anthropology 342, was the most popular as well as the most enduring of all summer session offerings, and was, of course, offered during the regular year as well. Any faculty member who advised students must, as I have encountered the student who refused to run his finger down the left-hand side of the course schedule where it lists title, credits, and numbers, but rather ran his finger down the right-hand column looking for the name of the instructor. Regardless of the course, he wanted a course by Dr. Scarland. And I suppose other advisors, again as I, developed the automatic response to this request, well, of course you should. How logical. Dr. Scarland was not only a teacher of anthropology. I'm sure most of you know that he received a BA in English from the then Alaska Agricultural College and School of Mines in 1935. And as it is an occupational hazard for all English teachers, he could never let a paper go by without checking the syntax and the punctuation in addition to the anthropological concepts. And this fetish, or this practice, led to one of his own favorite stories. During the summer session of 1958, two sisters from Kansas, school teachers, both of whom were in their 60s, were enrolled in Dr. Scarland's Alaska Natives course. These were sweet little gray-haired ladies, both of whom had taught the first grade for many years, and they spoke in kindly and precise sentences born from long years of instructing very young children. Following the return of the first quiz paper, the two little ladies were leaving the room unaware that Dr. Scarland was behind them. And one turned to the other and stated very clearly, yet very precisely, "I don't mind his correcting my anthropology, but when that damn Swede meddles with my English, that's too much." Of course, as a good Norwegian, Ivor thought being referred to as a Swede was doubly hilarious. Dr. Scarland never missed an appointment nor a deadline, to my knowledge. But he was, by his own account and admission, less than intrigued with committee meetings. In fact, he deplored them. A graduate student, Ivor was serving on her committee, stopped in his office one day and asked for an appointment to go over her thesis draft. Dr. Scarland carefully referred to his appointment calendar, thumbed over the pages where there were several blank spots, and finally it arrived at a notation which said committee meeting 2:00, and he said, "This is the perfect time for us to get together." The student, thinking he might have been a little confused, having read over his shoulder, could recall that there was a meeting at this time, again bringing forth the response, "Yes, yes, I know, this is what I mean." Last summer, Dr. Scarland presented a paper dealing with climate and culture change at the 7th International Congress of Anthropological and Ethnological Sciences in Moscow, held August 3rd through the 10th. Fortunately, in addition to the professional paper, he wrote a narrative of his trip, which included many Ivorisms, such as his description of Helsinki, in which he stated, "Sometimes one has the feeling that a statue has been put in a certain place just because it's more lasting than a tree." And he said in a postal card to me written last summer, "Mosquitoes here are plentiful, but they're lively and slow." He said one good Alaskan mosquito would run them all out of the country in a day. No account, however lengthy or brief, will do justice to the professional contributions made by Dr. Scarland. But suffice it to say, his reputation locally, nationally, and internationally is indelible. And in reflecting on our own personal lives, I suggest that this is probably more than any of us dare hope for.
Thank you. As a student and speaking as a student and for you all, I think that Dr. Scarlin was part of the stability factor of this campus, and a very strong one. We could see him coming down the halls of our office. We would see him in the cafeteria, eating with us. We would see him having coffee with us in the coffee shop. And we could always depend on his not-too-svelte self saying, "Hello, how are you?" We could depend on his mood. It would be cheerful because he didn't tolerate uncheerfulness or excessive unhappiness in students or in himself. And he was also always interested in you and your family and what you had done over the holidays, where you had gone. He was consistent, and his feelings were consistent. We could count on this. He just liked it. One girl told me in a slightly surprised voice that although she'd never had a class from him, he always said hello, and many of her own teachers didn't say this. Dr. Scarlin was a lesson in humanity, and he literally loved young people. He's always been known to not only give moral support, but he had been giving financial support to many of his students. But he never talked about this. Many of us didn't know this. The students who did tell us were the ones who received it. We were his, and if any student had a relative who had previously attended the U of A, Dr. Scarlin knew about it. In fact, Betty Harrop, who was in charge of the alumni service here, would ask Dr. Scarlin if he knew of students who had perhaps not told of relatives that they had who had attended the U of A. He knew about it. He knew about it just by looking at them. He could see a bloodline a mile long. And if that relative had been a classmate of his, the student was as good as related to Dr. Scarlin himself. He had a very long memory. As I said before, he could remember things that your parents did, and he could remember parts of your childhood if he even had so much of a glimpse of you then. He had a sense of humor, as we've heard so far, and the sharpness of it was completely counteract his poor hearing, as some of you who knew him knew he did have trouble here. I remember seeing him with different students and laughing uproariously over some private joke, but when you came up to see what was going on, you seldom found out because he would promptly work to bring out your own personality. This wasn't hypocritical. He cared about you, but he also kept quiet about things that he shared with other students. And the deeper the relationship a student had with him, the more humorous life seemed to be. He could lead you to laugh over situations that had buried you before. And this, in turn, kept you a little more stable.
Dr. Cutler, members of the faculty, members of the student body, ladies and gentlemen. Well, about 35 years ago, 1930, sometime in August or early September, there came a young fellow from the Healy coal mines up to the university to see Dr. Bunnell. And he was given the interview, and he was trying to explain to Dr. Bunnell that he'd like to come to college, which was fine, except that Dr. Bunnell could hardly understand what he was saying. He was a Norwegian fellow, spoke rather brokenly, and although his intentions were good, Dr. Bunnell had some trepidations about this. And so he said, "Well, Ivor, I'll tell you, I don't think you speak English quite well enough to go to college yet, and you talk kind of twisted. So why don't you go back to Healy for a year or so and think about it and maybe practice speaking. And if in the end of a year you still think you want to come to college, well, then come ahead." "All right, Ivor, I'll do that," and thanked him very much for departing. Well, of course, actually, he knew English pretty well, but he couldn't speak it very well. In his home country and Norway, he'd been quite a precocious youngster. In fact, he could read his own language before he went to school, in the newspapers. And he had a sister, I think, that kind of encouraged him. And he started studying English along in the third or fourth grade, and he had a good, solid education over there. Studied German and some French additionally, and English was practically a second language. But Nevertheless, when he came to this country, he was very self-conscious of the fact that his pronunciation was not quite what it should be, and he avoided as much as he could any opportunity to speak. He'd listen. He came to this country, I suppose, about 1927. His grandfather had been to California many years before and had told him stories about California and America. And so he came after finishing forestry school, which is equivalent of about a junior high school work here, I suppose, or junior college work. Came over to Canada, wound up in British Columbia in a logging camp as a lumberjack. And of course, the lumberjack, it happened to be a Scotch community, he related later, but he was a good soccer player and they wanted to put him on their team. So they changed his name to MacIver and put him aboard. Well, from there he came up to Juneau, and he claims that he used to claim that that's where he spotted me playing basketball, but that's an embarrassing story and I won't tell you that one. But he did enroll in the night school in Juneau, and Dr. William K. Keller, one of our, was the superintendent there at that time, and he said, Ivor interviewed him. Yes, he'd said, sign him up for citizenship night school. And so he attended night school there and took basic English, but he used to chuckle because he said he could catch the teacher making grammatical errors but couldn't correct her because he refused to talk about it. At any rate, after another year at Healy, he came up, enrolled at the university, and spent, I suppose, quite a frustrating freshman year. Because again, the professors were a little bit dubious about this fellow who wouldn't respond, and yet who seemed to have the answers and get good grades on his papers. At one time, I think Professor Southwick was going to find out once and for all whether he was doing his own work, so he separated the freshmen in far corners of the room, gave a very tough grammar test, and then an on-the-spot theme to write. And Ivor made up in the 90s, and the rest of them made down in the 50s and 60s, the story goes. Well, this English business led to my first association with Ivor. I came in 1933, and I thought I could write a decent enough theme, but I'd get back these Monday morning themes midweek, and they were covered with red marks. See your handbook, page such and such. See your handbook, page such and such. Well, it wasn't Professor Southwick's writing, and the scrawl was just a little bit foreign. And finally it came around that this fellow, that Scarlin, was correcting our English themes. And I felt pretty much the same as this school teacher many years later. The next summer, the end of the freshman year, it was my only association with Ivor that year. At the end of the summer, there was the first expedition to St. Lawrence Island under the leadership of Otto Geist. Now, Otto Geist had been over there in St. Lawrence Island doing private collections and investigations financed by Dr. Bunnell, but they had a grant this year from the Bureau of Indian Affairs to go over and do a quite an extensive excavation near Savoonga, Kukulik, I believe. And Otto Geist then assembled a crew to go over and help him for the summer. And among those selected was Ivor. Now, Carl Franklin went, and Roly Snodgrass, Mary McCammy, Will Lane, Harry Brandt. Well, there were about seven students, I think, along with Otto. And they had quite a year over there, and they all came back pretty good friends. Oh, yes, the cook was a fellow by the name of Percy Lucia. And Perk, we called him. And he and Ivor contrived one time, and they cooked up a seagull, I guess, and served it to the crew and told them it was turkey. And I don't know how they got away with it, but they did. The sophomore year, I was studying French, And I was walking every evening as I passed through the lobby. There would be Ivor. I didn't know him too well. But here he was reading a novel. And I thought, well, it's pretty easy life these arts and letters majors have, I guess. But it turned out that he was reading a novel in French. I think that year he read the complete works of Anatole France, or however you pronounce it. But he was reading it in French. He didn't bother to read any translation. So I thought, well, if he knows that much French, maybe he can help me. I was taking the subject, having a little difficulty. He did. That story I related in the local paper a while back about speaking French with a Norwegian accent, well, I still maintain it's true. Ivor graduated then in 1935. He had a 3.48 grade point average, just missed honors by a slight amount. And then he went on the second expedition to St. Lawrence, and I guess this kind of tied up his interest and solidified it to the extent that he was going to study anthropology. How to do it? Well, he had to go to graduate school. How to earn money? Well, go back to Healy. There was always a job at Healy. Early in his career, he ran across Cap Lathrop, and Cap took a liking to him, and I think Cap had offered to finance his way, but Ivor would never take any help of that kind. He'd work for a semester, and then he'd come to school, and when he ran out of money, he'd go back to Healy and work some more. But he went back to Healy then and started accumulating funds for graduate school. I remember he bought a typewriter, and he used to write me letters on the typewriter and told me just to practice his typing, but he enjoyed a nice correspondence. I graduated in 37 and went to Anchorage, and so our paths didn't cross for a little while again. But in 42, when I came back to join the faculty, I was happy to find that Ivor was here teaching anthropology. Then that spring, 43, the war being on, Ivor decided to enlist in the Army. Now, he was 44 years of age, and he was beyond the draft call. He had taken out his citizenship papers, and, in fact, he could have gone in to Air Corps administrative work, I think, with the rank of captain. And someplace in my mind, there's a little something about being some feelers out for intelligence, too, because he knew so many languages and because of his connections at Harvard. However, he decided that he wanted to enlist as a private. Once he made up his mind, that was it. And so he went to Fort Richardson and enrolled as a private and got in the group, I think, known as the Alaska Scouts. And they did quite a number of odds and ends. They had to take care of a dog team, and they had to make expeditions up down to the Aleutians and up to the Arctic. He did participate in quite an expedition when one of the Army planes crashed in the foothills of Mount McKinley. They called for volunteers. Of course, I was volunteered. And they sent in an expedition to recover the bodies from the wreckage. And they had to take train to Talkeetna and then take skis and go in over the trail. And it was a very cold and hazardous and difficult task, but it was accomplished with very well. And the unit received a citation, commendation for their fine work. Along with it, of course, he conducted or helped conduct cold weather tests on clothing and food. And this is a story I picked up from some Anchorage friends. They asked me if I knew Ivor later on after the war, and I said yes. Well, it seems that Ivor would write up the report of these cold weather tests on gear and equipment. And the lieutenant would get them and say, these are pretty good. He'd sign his initials to it and bucket up the line. And it seems that there were letters of congratulation going on up and down the line about these fine reports coming out, all written by Private Scarlett. Everyone was trying to get him in their unit, but sorry. Well, then after the war, he came back and joined the faculty again, took time off to get his PhD at Harvard, and so the rest of it is pretty much modern history. You know his life pretty much since the war. Some of you will remember him for his skiing, Every year, as students, I recall, Ivor would come around and take orders to see if he wanted skis, and he'd send to Norway and get a dozen or so pair of skis, and he'd spend countless hours on Saturday and Sunday teaching you to ski, cross-country ski, if you wanted to do that. The Fourth of July, the early ice carnival celebrations that we had in, well, Ivor would always take first place in the cross-country ski runs. On the campus ski races, he wouldn't compete unless there were some real good ones, but he'd run exhibition races after the college students had done their competing work and taken the prizes. There are many facets of Ivor's character, as has been pointed out. This interest in students has been brought out, and it was genuine and sincere. His ability, I think, to get along with people in all walks of life, regardless of their station. I've seen them stop in the middle of the street and talk to a person from one of the villages, or a native, or an Eskimo, and feel perfectly at home with them. And then, of course, with fine professional men visiting the campus, equally at ease in all walks of life. His professional attitude, I think, was good. He wasn't just out to drag students into his department. I think he was very, very, very good about advising students, told them about what the opportunities were in anthropology, that it would take considerable graduate work in order to get ahead in that field. And he did pretty well. He's encouraged four that Dr. Irving and I were reciting the other day. Four of his students have gone on and are doing pretty well. You know some of them. Dr. Irving's son, William Irving, now a PhD. He's with the Natural Museum in Ottawa. George Schaller is working out of the University of Wisconsin. He's, I think, the world's authority now on apes, or gorillas. I don't know where he got that. Randall Oswalt, who teaches here during the summer every once in a while, teaches at the University of California in Los Angeles. Dr. Fred Milan is out here at the Aeromedical Lab. Four students that got their early start with Ivor Scarf. The log cabin on the hill, I suppose it will be gone here pretty soon, some of these days, but it has kind of a history of its own. It was built by Frolic Rainey, our first professor of anthropology, back in 1937. We didn't even know what anthropology was when he came, but anthropology became quite an important part of our curriculum. Later, Giddings lived in it, Lewis Giddings, and Helge Larsen lived in it. Ivor began to consider it kind of the anthropology house, and so in the early 50s, he moved there. Many years he batched with John Mailer, and another years, later years, with Dr. Geist, Otto Geist. And his home was always the scene of hospitality and the best of friendship. And, I won't tell you about the good times I've had there, but I'm sure all of you who knew Ivor knew that the door was always open, stopping in on your ski runs or your little hikes. Well, these then are some of the personal reflections as I look back about my good friend Ivor. And just in conclusion, let's say that the university is a lot better place because Ivor Scarland has been here. And I think we're a lot better people for having known him.
President Wood deeply regretted that other university business compelled his absence this afternoon. He penned these words: high along the crest of Rainy Ridge, his woodsman's lodge just there ahead, he fell alone. A great north spruce, frost-laden, toppled quietly. Here, an empty, aching void against the ice-blue sky. There,
surely the hall of heroes, the hands of Ben and Otto reach out in happy greeting. He taught us all the simple, honest truth. We loved and honored him as he did us.